views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we are going to dive into Vault 7, the massive document dump by WikiLeaks last week. We're going to bring back to the program Bob Weiss. He's our ethical hacker, and he's going to explain his views on what the WikiLeaks Vault 7 is about. And we're also going to relate it to what we've talked about in the past. Is there anything new? It's only 1% of the dump. I imagine there's going to be new stuff about the CIA. But in this current dump of documents, is there anything new that we learned, and what have we learned? And then talk about things in general. And after we have that interview with Bob Weiss, I'm going to play part of my interview with Cliff High. I bring him back to the program. He's the founder of Predictive Linguistics. And he is so interesting. Again, it just kind of excites my X-File whole side of me. And I love talking with him because it's just so fascinating to think about the things that he's come up with. But, you know, it's not all crazy stuff. A lot of it, too, is what's going on with the stock market. What are the interesting thing with Cliff High is it's really what the state of people's emotions are. And if people's emotions in our society are going to bring up all sorts of crazy stuff. And like he says, I don't add any, it's not my own. He tries very hard not to add his own stuff. These are actual emotional changes that he's finding in people. And it's on all sorts of areas and subjects. So really fascinating. So we're going to bring him on after our interview with Bob Weiss. So let's have Bob join the program now. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on right now. We've dived into cyber warfare and a lot of these things that they're talking about with Vault 7.
And yes,
we have. And, you know, and we covered NSA really deep. What is new in this release by WikiLeaks that was not, that we didn't know before?
Well, you know, honestly, I'd have to say that there's probably a lot of overlap between, you know, the kinds of exploits that NSA is using and the CIA is using. I have to imagine they're sharing between the organizations and, quite frankly, between the organizations and the wealth of cyber criminals who are developing malicious code out there too. I'm sure some of the code that's for sale on the dark net is ending up in a CIA software lab somewhere, and somebody's beating it into shape to turn it into a weapon. So, you know, I think they're sharing. You know, the interesting thing, you know, you mentioned the Julian Assange had a press conference today, and I took a minute to watch it before we spoke, and I thought it was really interesting in that he was positioning this as the issue wasn't that, hey, we got all this CIA stuff. The issue is, hey, this CIA stuff was floating around out there, and we just got some in addition to a bunch of other people. And his main issue is that he's unhappy that there are cyber weapons, you know, cyber warfare tools that are basically available now for anybody. That was an interesting take on it, because we have problems, of course, with regular weapons getting stolen and military grade weapons turning up in the hands of criminals and things like that. But the point he made is that the cyber weapons are just easier to move, you know, because they're digital, they're files. And like any other, whether it's movies or music or, you know, illegally obtained legitimate software or whatever, this stuff is easy to lose track of, hard to secure, and super easy to transport and distribute. as opposed to, say, real weapons, which if it's like a tank or a fighter jet, well, that's really hard to move. So it was kind of an interesting point.
Well, I think it's a very interesting point because it's like the military criminals getting in the whole stockpile of military weapons, except these are cyber weapons. He flat out and said he can't believe how incompetent the CIA was that they could get our whole stash of the CIA's cyber weapons.
Yeah, and the fact is, if WikiLeaks has it, everybody's got it. The frickin' ISIS has probably got some of this stuff and going, hey.
Well, he was saying that it's costing companies billions of dollars. And WikiLeaks themselves are developing tools to help people combat these weapons. And he's
right,
what are they motivated by? What do you think of WikiLeaks first?
Well, I think they fill an important role in keeping everybody honest. Well, but it doesn't keep everybody honest, but it holds their feet to the fire when the people are being dishonest, I guess. There were a number of things in his press conference that stood out. The first one was that he was looking at this trove strictly as a member of the press, as a journalism professional, and saying these are tools that would be used against journalists and their sources. Well, yes, but also against oppositional party in a political camp, in a country where politics is maybe not quite as free as it could be. It can be used against one nation state against another one. It can be used, frankly, some of these tools could be used by an individual against, like, to spy on a spouse or to spy on somebody else. I'm seeing some of this stuff going back into use in cybercrime and what have you. The other thing that stood out to me was he mentioned something about getting a new Geneva Convention to put some rules around cyber warfare to protect civilians from the effects of cyber warfare. And honestly, that's not a bad idea. And the third thing, that they are handling this information quite responsibly, frankly, because they're talking about what they have, but they're not putting the code out there too. And toward the end of his press release, he was talking about sharing the code with legitimate technology companies so that they can create countermeasures to, like, Sony or Samsung TVs that have been compromised by some exploits, giving them the code so they could create protections from that code. So that was interesting to me, too.
He dug into the black budget of the CIA. And mm-hmm. one thing that I thought was interesting is that one third is used to go after extremists, terrorists mm-hmm. and extremist groups. And the other vast amount is for geopolitical reasons, like what you were saying, for making sure that businesses can get their deal, spying on exporting companies in Germany, or trying to turn an election in Turkey or elsewhere. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, that's why when we were getting our collective selves all bent out of shape about the Russians allegedly messing around with the elections, I had an article in my blog where I believe the Russians were doing it? And I said, sure, but I don't care, because we do it all over the world, all the time. We're constantly influencing the outcome of elections by covert means, by direct sponsorship, by direct payments, by indirect payments in the form of foreign aid programs, where significant amounts of money are diverted to the ruling person and their cronies, as opposed to actually helping anybody. So this is just like, hey, back at you, United States. And to a certain extent, I'm shrugging my shoulders and going, well.
We do it everywhere.
Play with fire, get burned, I mean, what's hard to believe about that?
Well, I think what's very serious, though, is the harming of U.S. businesses, and that mm-hmm. China and other countries are not trusting the U.S. exports of mobile phones and computers because of the CIA hacking on those products. And that is costing our companies billions of dollars.
Most of that stuff is manufactured in China for American companies to sell. And it turned out that there was a chip that had been added to the specifications that gave the Chinese a backdoor into all the internet routers that were going out,
So it's happening from all directions.
So it's kind of like, can you trust your toys? No, you can't. Does that mean I'm not going to have a smartphone? sure, I'll have a smartphone, but I know damn well it's spying on me 24/7.
Well, exactly. You know,
if it wasn't baked in by Google in order to push ads to me, it was baked in by somebody else in order to actually just spy.
Well, who does the CIA specifically target? Do they target all of us, including businesses, university, and organizations? What do you...
Theoretically, their mandate is to work exclusively outside of the continental United States, but those lines have been blurred. There's a lot of CIA-FBI joint operations because, unfortunately, criminals and cyber criminals and terrorists and the people that they're supposed to protect us from don't recognize borders and boundaries either. So I should go back and find out what the whole deal was with setting up the CIA. So it could not work in the continental United States, as there was a reason for that.
Well, Truman put out a letter saying what the purpose was to bring information to him as a president. And that was the only reason it was for, because the agencies were putting their own agenda or putting their own spin on it and giving them information. So he created this agency so that he would just get raw information. But now they're doing all sorts of stuff. It's nowhere near the original intent of the organization.
Yeah. I mean, the CIA started in World War II as the Office of Special Services or Strategic Services, or with the OSS, and it was all about spying on the Nazis at that point, and then the Japanese.
Well, that's different than what Truman wrote.
I'm thinking that there may have been, because when the CIA was coming along as a governmental agency in the 50s, you know, the one that was there forever,
Hoover.
Gosh darn it. Hoover, yeah. He probably put his foot down and said, they cannot have a mandate inside the United States because that's FBI territory. And that may really be the real reason. J. Edgar Hoover probably drew a line, and he had so much dirt. Hoover stayed in power because he could destroy anybody.
Well, he could. I know.
Yeah. So if some elected official would come and try to rein him in, it's kind of like, yeah, let me show you some stuff I got. And then it's sort of like, okay, well, we don't want that coming out. So he was a clever dude who managed to stay in power for a long time. And I suspect that that may have had something to do with it. What I find interesting, I haven't had a lot of opportunity to go into details on the Vault 7 stuff. There's just so much. The Frankfurt Consulate connection that he was talking about struck me as being really, really interesting, that we have basically a cyber war group in Frankfurt, Germany, which, of course, Frankfurt is not like the capital of Germany, at least not anymore. But we have this huge big consulate there that mostly for electronic eavesdropping and the activities of one sort or another for Europe and Africa and Asia.
Well, you said that you have to be close. For some of the stuff, you need to be close to the target. You know, why can't they do it all in Langley? Well, in some of these situations, you have to be close to the target to actually be able to get at them.
Yep.
But the other thing I thought was interesting is the NSA used to be bigger and more powerful than the CIA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now the CIA has 1.5 times the budget of NSA, and they are doing all their own activities, and they don't have to rely on the CIA or the NSA as much. And they have less oversight than the NSA, as if oversight really is helping, but they have less oversight. They're more of a rogue organization than the NSA is.
Yeah, indeed. I just think I've watched way too many Jason Bourne movies. There's a part of me that goes, these movies probably are not even touching the tip of the iceberg in terms of like what kind of stuff really, really happens. But we hear about you hear about stuff that gives somebody leaks, Private Manning, Snowden, these people, and then confirms things that we suspected. So it's not so much that it was a big freaking surprise, but to know for certain something that you've believed to be true, but it didn't have, shall we say, evidence. Well, that does take it to a different level. But the other thing that we have to think about here is that it's not just the NSA and the military and the State Department and the CIA that's leaking stuff all over the place. It's happening everywhere. We just don't hear about it here in the United States because the United States doesn't report in the news anything that happens anywhere else in the world unless, of course, it has a connection to somebody in the United States. If you read the foreign press or occasionally dial over to BBC World News at 10 instead of the local channels, you get a taste for the fact that this is a worldwide phenomenon.
It is. It's happening everywhere. One thing that Assange was saying is that we tend to think that everybody's attacking us and the WikiLeaks is attacking us. And it seems like that because it seems like they're only putting out articles on us because that's what the news is reporting. But they've put out hundreds of thousands of things on Russia on China and also millions on Syria. Turkey just imprisoned 7 journalists for what they put out on them. I've had people send me messages irate that I even say anything about WikiLeaks because they say that it's a Russian organization and they've never published a single thing about Russia. And I'm like, well, I don't think Julian Assange has ever been caught lying, and what he says has always been checked out. There's millions of documents.
I was just really impressed. His press conference, it was very low key, wasn't making a big production out of it, practically boring in the way he was delivering it. Sort of like, we're not putting this out there to be a sensation. We're putting it out there because this stuff is scary, and we think people deserve to know that that these risks exist for them. And I think that's fair. If my big television, big screen TV is going to be spying on me, I guess I'd like to know that.
Well, can you summarize really what are the risks? Because people don't understand, you know, when Julian Assange is talking about cyber warfare and he's talking about all these tools, I don't think people can relate to what it really means to them. So what if somebody can look into my phone? I'm not doing anything wrong anyways. They don't realize.
Not that you know of.
Well, yeah. So I don't think they realize how dangerous this can be. Can you give us a couple examples of how dangerous cyber warfare? We've covered this in the past. But let's revisit a couple of these things.
Well, and I posted a few things in my web blog kind of about stuff like this. For instance, your smartphone can be turned into a personal surveillance unit. The microphone can be turned on so that whoever's infected your phone can listen in and hear what's going on. They can also be getting your GPS coordinates. If the camera is pointed in any direction that's even remotely interesting, they can see what's going on from your camera. I mean, I carry my phone in my shirt pocket, the breast pocket of my shirt, and I noticed a while ago that it's just at the right depth so the camera just sticks out over the top. Well, I've used my smartphone camera to make surreptitious video recordings, but that feature can, while you're in a conversation with somebody, because it's like the camera's running, there's no little blinky light. Well, that feature can be turned against you too. And that's just a smartphone. There was an amusing little article about how Hamas in Palestine had tricked Israeli soldiers into downloading an app that actually turned their phones into surveillance equipment. And so the Hamas would know where these Israeli soldiers were located and could listen in to things that were happening where they were at and locate them with GPS. And it's like, that takes cyber warfare to a whole new level. I mean, this is cyber warfare on top of real warfare, right?
Exactly. You know,
so there was that. That was kind of interesting. But the fact that anything with a camera can be hijacked to record for somebody else. Anything with a microphone can be hijacked as a listening device. Speakers can be converted into microphones and anything. So anything with a speaker can be used as a listening device too. I mean, when you think about it, okay, speakers and microphones do the same thing, but one does them in reverse. Okay. A microphone picks up pressure waves going through the atmosphere and turns them into electrical waves. And a speaker takes electrical waves and turns them back into pressure waves in the atmosphere. Well, you can turn them around and have them do the opposite. And so there's that.
I think people realize why it was such an important part of our Constitution, right? Because at the time we formed our government, the persecution that was going on that they were running from in Europe was that they could come in and take anything they wanted and do search and seizure and everything else. And so this privacy was a big deal. And now we're moving back to that.
Kind of giving it all away. Yeah.
Yeah. And they fought so hard for it. And people are naively feeling comfortable that that is something that can't happen again.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, okay, so, you know, I don't care if somebody's spying on my phone because I'm not doing anything important. It's kind of like, well, if it's a criminal spying on you, they're going to figure out ways
exactly.
to liberate you from your stuff, your money, whatever. But, you know, here's the thing. Okay. So you're living your life and you're boring little life and you're keeping your mouth shut and you're keeping your head down. You're doing good work and whatever. And one day you get up and something's just got your, today you're motivated, you're irritated. Something happened and you're just really, and so now you become, shall we say, politically or socially active for whatever reason. Who cares what it is? Okay. You got a parking ticket and now you're going to investigate the meter people. Okay. Well, if you become enough of an irritation to somebody in political with political clout and they can spy on you with relative ease, now they can find out the kind of information it would take to have you arrested on, even if they're like really weak. I mean, and we're always doing something that is against the law someplace. I mean, there's so many of them. How could you know? And so it could be that you ticked off the mayor and the mayor goes to the PD and the PD starts a surveillance on you. And without any kind of controls over this, well, it just becomes really dangerous to speak your mind. And, well, speaking your mind is what this country is founded on.
Well,
so, you know, that's why it's the First Amendment and the, you know,
exactly. It's the First Amendment.
And so to a certain extent, the police are not supposed to have an easy time of it because we're supposed to have an easy time of it. And that means that the bad guys are going to have an easy time of it for a while until there's a case, you know, built. The whole thing about we don't like encryption because that means we can't eavesdrop. Good. And what should we be doing as individuals? We should all be using encrypted services as much as humanly possible so that when all the traffic is encrypted, they're just going to have to stop listening, you know, because there's nothing to listen to.
That unless they have a warrant or something else
and,
or
yeah,
they have some way.
And then you have to get into the what Julian was pointing out is that some of these exploits take over at the machine level. And there you have it. In order to properly eavesdrop on somebody, you need to be able to find a way to get a hold of their personal gear and set it up that way so it can be listened into, not just be scooping up every conversation on the internet and letting machines listen for keywords. I mean, that's...
Well, what do you think about the CIA being such an easy target, that their secrets were so easily proliferated out through the internet and they were... Not
yeah.
even keeping them safe.
Well, and you know, I was talking with a guy at work and he was, most people in the United States tend to be pro-United States. And he's kind of taken the popular viewpoint of, holy crap, why do people keep picking on, you know, how can we keep ourselves safe if all this stuff keeps getting leaked out? And the implication being that the person who leaked it should be flogged in the public square and hung from a flagpole. And I said to him, I said, you got to remember something here. So if you want to be a highly paid government hacker, the first thing you have to do is hack something illegally and get caught, which is to say that the hackers that are working at the CIA and the NSA, the people with real skills, got pinched and went to prison. And after they let them, you know, simmer in prison for a little while, somebody from a federal governmental department would come and visit them in prison and said, have you had enough? Because we're going to make you an offer, you know, and it's good for like about 22 seconds. And it's like, you can stay here. That's option one. And option two is you'll become an employee of the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, the whoever. You'll be under Homeland Security and you'll be working for us and using your incredible skills in ways that we direct. What do you think? Plus you get paid and you'll be able to, you know. Well, okay. So is it so surprising that people who already have established the ability, their intention to have criminal intent, that they would turn around and bite the hand that feeds them at some point? No, not shocking at all. The fact that this stuff gets out, it's a miracle it doesn't get out more often, because a lot of these people that were hired through the incarceration process were anti-government people or very anti-establishment people or kind of like political anarchists or whatever. And they're working for the very organizations that in many cases they were opposed to. And it's, and someday they're going to wake up and they're going to revert back to who they were. You just,
if you're going to hire a bad guy, they're going to be a bad guy.
Yeah.
Or you, wherever they
or if,
are.
Or if you hire an, you know, some anti-establishment hacker dude out of Anonymous, don't be surprised when he decides that he can't stomach what he's doing anymore. It was against his nature. But it sounds to me like, from what I've been reading and what I heard today from that press conference, is that this isn't a Snowden case. This isn't a Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning case. This is a case of, we had this cool stuff and we gave it to people that we liked, and somehow it got into the wild. And well, hey, guess what? It's going to happen. But the other thing is that if, okay, so I'm deploying an exploit on a computer, that exploit is going to be on that computer to be able to be analyzed by whoever figures out that something's going on. And that's how Stuxnet was detected by a researcher when it got out of Natan's facility and into the wild. And he figured out what it was doing through analysis. And this is the problem with these types of cyber weapons, is that they leave a copy of themselves on a system that belongs to the bad guys.
Yeah, and then they can find it, and then they can.
And then they can, yeah. And you hire your own smart hacker dude, and he tells you what's going on there, and then you build yourself a protection for it, or you go, hey, cool, and you use it yourself against somebody else. It's kind of like if somebody you found a surveillance device in your house, and it's like, rather than smashing with a hammer, you went, cool. And you figured out how to use it, and then you used it to spy on, you know, your spouse. or your boss, or who knows what.
Well, but it seemed like with all the CIA tools being everywhere, they just created a complete nightmare for businesses and governments and us. I mean, we had a big mess on our hands. We had a mess on our hands before that. Now we really have a mess on our hands.
Yeah, and there was an interesting, golly, I'm trying to remember who it was. There was a group who came into contact with some supposedly spy grade hacker tools, and they had an auction. They were, you know, first guy would have come up with $1 million and Bitcoin was going to win, and they didn't get anywhere. But I'd heard that the trove of stuff they had actually been scavenged off a hard drive from a company that had been a governmental contractor for, I forget who, CIA or FBI or whatever. And I could look up the specifics, but let's just say that. So this is a much bigger version of that, in that somebody left it sitting around on a computer somewhere that got free, and the contents came out.
What do you mean by evading forensics and antivirus?
Oh,
what is that?
Yeah.
What were you talking about when you mentioned that to me earlier?
Well, there are kinds of code that are, well, okay, so the way that antivirus software works, first of all, is that you find an example of the malicious code, and then you write a little bit of software we call a signature that detects that code. So when it shows up anywhere else, the antivirus software will find it and then remove it. You know, they're basically written so that it'll recognize it when it sees it and knows where to go to remove it. In order to avoid that happening to your exploit, you're going to take that software and rewrite it in ways that make it no longer recognizable to the antivirus products that are out there. So that's what they're talking about by evading antivirus. In order to evade forensics, your exploit needs to go in, do what it needs to do, and then erase itself on its way out the door, basically removing all traces. But it would also do things like erasing the event logs and the security logs that every computer runs, just as part of the Windows operating system. Of course, you know, we don't know that, but it's there. And so they actually, going back to Stuxnet, Stuxnet was written to do that. It was written to go in, cause mayhem, and then on a certain date and time to uninstall itself and destroy itself. And there was the fact that it, that second and third versions of Stuxnet, that feature was poorly written, that, and it didn't kill itself in the later versions. And that's how that got discovered. I spend most of my time not worrying about cyber war or government intrusions. I'm just going and, you know, trying to defend against cyber criminals. But this kind of functionality exists in their code too. A well-written code is designed to hide and designed to go away on its own if you really don't want anybody to know that you were there.
Well, how much are the cyber criminals using the CIA tools now? Because if it got all over the place, now we got the every Joe Blow cyber criminal is going to be using it.
Yeah, I think we're going to see this stuff leaked, if it isn't already, out there on the dark web. But this was part of what they were talking about, or what Julian Assange was talking about, what covered a part of this. And it's kind of like this. Okay, so every coder, every software writer writes in a style that ends up being uniquely their own and makes their work identifiable to somebody who's analyzing it. Okay. So there, for instance, on the Sony hack, there was certain things in the code that pointed to North Korea, and the Grizzly Step and the Russian election hacks. There was certain elements in the code that pointed back to Russia. What the CIA has been doing is borrowing code from other code creators, from, you know, other malware writers, including Russian and, you know, the average cyber criminal type code writing and what have you, and using it as part of the code base in an effort to obfuscate or make difficult to figure out where it's really come from.
Or make it look like it's from Russia.
Yeah, or make it look like it's from Russia, exactly. And maybe we need to kind of rethink that. You know, maybe it wasn't the Russians playing with the election. Maybe it was the CIA. You know, who knows?
Well, you don't know. That's the whole point, is that once the cyber attacks, all these things get out there, you don't know really who the source was, because maybe Russia wrote it in the first place, but who really knows? Right? Well, I mean, that's the whole point. It could have been any country.
Well, and this is one of the things that that we talk about among ourselves, you know, those of us that are in the cybersecurity game, is that attribution, which is basically figuring out who did it and who to blame, and, you know, at the end of the day, who to prosecute if we ever get a chance to arrest them. Attribution is very, very difficult.
Well, especially with this kind of stuff out there.
Yeah,
and if
they're
very talented in a bad way, you will have no idea.
Well, and if you're if you're mounting an attack, you're going to do it from a computer that isn't your own and that's located in somebody's home or business. You're going to route that so that if they trace the IP address back, it's a dead end. You're going to route all the traffic through an anonymizing service like Tor, so that it bounces halfway around the world before it actually gets where it's going, and it makes it very, very hard to trace back. And so, you know, I mean, if I were going to pull a caper myself personally, the first thing I do is find a way to compromise a computer that's halfway around the world, hook it up with Tor, and play from a very remote host. And then in the event that, you know, whatever I'm doing is discovered, tracing it back to me gets to be really, really hard.
Well, this is just a fascinating thing that is going on. I think Vault 7 is another development that's just changing our world. It's changing the way we look at our Constitution in the United States. And I'm sure as this thing starts to develop, we're going to have to get back together and talk about, just kind of assess where everything is at and what's really going on. Because it's going to take about a month here to work itself out. And we should get back together to talk about it next month.
Yeah, sure. That'll be great.
Yeah, that'll be great. Thank you so much for joining the program.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That's all we have with Bob Weiss today. If you want his contact information, I will have that up on my radio page at sarahwestall.com. And you can find out how to get to his blog. He does blog articles almost once a day. A lot of very interesting information that he puts out there. So now we're going to get into my interview with Cliff High. And here we go. Hi, Cliff. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. You're always so much fun. Last time you were on, I had such a great time talking to you, and I expect the same. I want to dive right in. What is the deep state? You talk about it a lot in your new report, and talking about it somewhat, there's a lot of things you talk about in your new report. We have a lot to talk about here. What is the deep state? Because the Fox News is starting to talk about the deep state. People talk about the deep state. I think it's people don't even really know what the deep state is.
In my definition, the deep state is are all of those individuals that are involved in, there's a couple of ways to define it. One way would be to say that everybody who works for government, but it's really not that. It's all of those individuals that are part of the deep state, regardless of who is in charge of the government. So this would be all the civil servants, but it would also be all of the subcontractors. And so, for instance, the subcontractors would frequently have more power than any political appointee, because they could, the subcontractor could simply withhold information from a political appointee and, in essence, neuter them at their job. And they do this quite frequently. So the deep state are these subcontractors that are corporations and the people that work for them. And they are extremely powerful in what we all perceive out here on the outside as government. And so government is not this big, giant, monolithic sort of a thing. It's all of the people that go to work and do their regular job, you know, at DMV and the Board of Health that supervises, postal deliveries or any of this sort of thing. Then there's the other part of the deep state, which is all the subcontractors that control all the information. They handle all the machinery for the NSA and the CIA. They're involved in the reverse engineering of all of the space alien crash ships and all of the holes in the ground in Area 51 and Wright-Patterson and in Utah and up here in Washington State and all of these kind of places. They're also involved in the secret space program that's out and about at least in the near Earth orbit. And we can actually see the evidence of the deep state in the secret space program. If you go and get hold of these third generation night vision goggles, go out about an hour and a half or so after the sun is set. That's your best viewing time. And you, if you're lucky, after two or three or four days, you'll all of a sudden witness some activity up there that'll sit you back on your butt and you'll say, holy crud, what's going on here? And you'll recognize that indeed you're looking at basically a human activity that you haven't been told about that's going on over your head, so to speak, about 145 miles out into the near Earth orbit. And all of these people are part of and compose the deep state. Now, there's, like all the other organizations within government, it's also compartmentalized and not monolithic in its nature as well. But in general, what we're witnessing up here now on the outside at the surface level is a fracturing of the deep state in the ongoing political battles that should have been settled by the presidential election.
Yeah, because you talk about, discuss the deep state power struggles, and one side is beating the other, and it could last for 50 years.
Correct. It'll go on for some time because the we've been living in a secrecy state that's been ongoing since really clamped down at least 70 years, but has been ongoing maybe since the 1890s at some subtle level. And so it's got a lot of emotional and historical baggage with it, and it's a big dinosaur, and it's going to take a long time to effectively have this battle won, and then all of the little bits and pieces cleaned up. So, and as I say, it's big. We can't say exactly how large the deep state is in terms of the number of people involved, because we're unaware and are deliberately kept ignorant of how many people work in all these special access projects for the subcontractors. It's quite a labyrinth out there. We get hints occasionally with Ben Rich from Lockheed Martin, or JPL, I think, that said, you know, we now have the technology to take ET home. And this was in the 90s. And so what do they have now? Well, if you look, you can see them flying around out there, and things are just getting a little weird all over. And it, and that little weirdness that we're seeing in the political realm is just one aspect of the fracturing or the internal power struggle that's going on within the deep state. And we saw this shift. One of the things we've seen now is the consolidation of this power shift as faction B is basically taking over the deep state. It's removing its opposition in a very business-like fashion.
So do you think that transparency will start to go away? Because that's the big thing. There's nothing is transparent, and they make everything top secret, whether it is or not. And so do you think those onion layers are going to start being peeled?
To those who want to go and look, but in general, I think not. There's a lot of reasons for the secrecy, even if there was an idea that we should live in a totally open and accessible society. It will take decades to undo the secrecy layers. It's estimated that, and you can't know for sure because it's made secret,
exactly,
but it's estimated that half of all documents in the normal course of business of the federal government are classified. And the same can be said at some level for the state, local, and so on. So I think that that'll just keep on going for decades just because it's part of doing business.
But their culture.
Correct. It's part of the culture. But there are indeed signs that things are changing. So, for instance, we get the Vault 7 WikiLeaks release today that shows how the CIA has been tapping into all of our electronics, trying to control our cars, can turn on the microphone in your Samsung TV and record what you're saying, all of these kind of things. And so this information comes out. How many people will make use of it is another question entirely.
So it'll start coming out. It's just whether the people want to dig and look at it.
Yes. And actually, I think there's going to be so much that it'll will be overwhelmed for a number of decades as we all try and sort through and decide what is, you know, pertinent and profitable for us at a personal level.
Well, how does the global pedophile network tie into the deep state?
The deep state had there was a situation, okay, it started in the 1860s or 70s, I think. There was a situation within the Masonic lodges of the United States. The United States was basically a Masonic country. We were not a Christian country per se. We weren't religious. We were a Masonic country. There were 55,000, I think, Masonic lodges throughout the established boundaries of the United States. What happened was this fellow was killed. They hauled the murderer. Everybody witnessed the murder. They hauled him into trial in front of a jury of Masons and a judge who was a Mason, and he was acquitted, even though he was flat out guilty. This caused a revolution that went on and through to the 1890s that created the anti-Masonic party. And the Masons had an issue there. They had most of the lodges closed. There were only about 15,000 left in the country at that period of time. But what happened at that point was that these people at that point came on in as the Masonic lodges were dying in this country, and they took over the remnant. And it is that group that then used the Masonic lodges in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and onward with a very tightly controlled secrecy ethos to harbor and culture pedophilia. They use this as a technique to control people in power, because once they indulged in this or were part of it, they were thereafter always blackmailable. And so this allowed the architects of our current situation to get into power using the secrecy of the lodge, which is naturally there, but they took it one layer deeper, and then also using the pedophilia network as a method of control. And so they've used it within business corporations. They've used it within the high tech industries. They've used it within political realm, royals, et cetera. And as the battle comes on out, that which was their most potent weapon to keeping people under control now makes all of those people so vulnerable that it makes them the weakest point or the easiest point of attack. And it's also the most potent weapon that Faction B has now against individuals within Faction A. So in my reading of what's going on, Faction B is waging a multiple front war in its consolidation, or consolidation after the major battle has been won. And what they're doing is they're picking off individuals as they're rounding up the pedophile network in order to do it in a strategic fashion. That's why we don't see them running on out and arresting Podesta, that kind of thing. That aspect of it will come much later.
Well, because I talked to FBI agent that talked about how they're going after pedophile trafficking. He wouldn't talk about the details because like you were saying, I heard you in another video, it's a very serious, very professional takedown situation.
Correct. And everything beyond that is speculation. And at this point, I expect, we have some speculation I don't mind discussing. That is because we have a trend in being reported in our data that up to a third of the famous faces that we see in the broadcast media will be gone, either through direct complicity or through aiding someone involved. They'll either be arrested or they'll flee the country. So this is interesting, and I put it in the report, and I don't have to get into names.
It's terrible.
Yeah. It's beyond terrible. I mean, it's truly an evil sort of a thing, especially since we now see that they were Faction A, the people that were doing all of this, were actually attempting to engineer the social contract away from its current standards to allow pedophilia as an accepted part of the social order. But they were also they were taking us out to cannibalism as well.
Oh, geez. So now, Faction B, are they the good guys overall? I mean, do they have skeletons in the closet and issues that is coming up in your reports?
Faction B, it's kind of naive to think of them as good guys and bad guys. Faction B are good guys for me simply because they're not Faction A, and they are more aligned with my way of thinking. So I think of them as more amicable, more of a fellow traveler to my worldview. But Faction B, bear in mind, is still part of the deep state. They've been suppressing technologies, killing people, doing all these very terrible, ugly things to engineer revolutions and overthrow countries and causing death, murder, and mayhem around the planet for the past 70 years. And Faction B is ever bit as deep in it as anybody else. Many of the people that are currently working most effectively for Faction B were trained by the overall deep state to go and overthrow countries. And they were trained over the course of the last 40 or 50 years, and they're very good at that. And these are very, serious individuals. And so they're going to have a serious background and that you and I wouldn't want to particularly discuss at a dinner party.
Yeah. So Faction B is all what you say, but they're into more transparency and they're against global pedophilia and some of the more evils that we're talking about.
Correct. I think that they, in my estimation, they have a much longer view of what's going on. So the problem is the minds that are involved here. You get into people that are able to be controlled by pedophilia. It's a particular kind of a mind where they're trapped in their body mind. They're very sensory oriented. Their view of reality extends maybe a couple of years into their life, if you're lucky. Whereas the Faction B guys were thinking, well, this in general is not good for humanity 100 years from now. And so these people think beyond the end of their own life.
Well, that's good. Lives.
That's very good in my estimation, because they have a much more, they want to have a much more stable view of the now in order that 100-year vision might have a chance of fruition.
Okay, let's talk about the mass media versus alternative media. You have words in there. It says forcing political changes as the breakdown of the legacy corporation media narrative. And how does that all tie in? Because I know that's part of the deep state
power
struggles.
And that's been some of their, right? That's been some of their real problem. They had a big issue, okay? Way back when in the late 70s, they made a decision. They knew what they were doing at the time they made the decision. Faction B may have pushed a particular way at that point, but they had to get the internet out in order to get us all connected. But they knew that it was letting out Pandora's box, because all of us would talk to each other and here we go, right? And here we are now. And so they were afraid of that, but that had to come on out. In the process of that, of course, we're educating our individual minds, and more and it's a situation, if you looked at it one way, more and more people are drifting away from being force-fed information by broadcast media. Now, as that occurs, the natural tendency is to isolation. Where you just sort of walk around because you're not part of it anymore. You think everybody else still is, and you don't even really question this little subset of assumption that you've got. But with the internet these days, we're able to naturally seek out information, and along the way, we find other individuals, such as yourself and your radio show, that points people into particular directions, and so we start cross-connecting. And then we get this combinoric effect to where everybody becomes a researcher for themselves and for everybody else. We start sharing, and this disruptive nature of humans chatting to each other really gets rolling. And that's where we're at now. So the legacy media is dying as a result of simply the way that humans want to communicate with each other. We don't want to be force-fed. We want to participate. We've all got our own stories to get out, and this is part of who we are and what we want to do. And so that we've been shoehorned by the broadcast media all of these years, when it breaks loose, as we've seen in the internet, it breaks loose with a vengeance. And that's where we're at the moment. And so the legacy media, you see their numbers are dying no matter what they do. There is no electronic model that makes broadcast media palatable in this day and age. I won't accept it. I don't want to have anything shoved at me. And I know there's bazillions of other people.
Well, I think we have a new renaissance going on in every field because of the internet. That's a very positive thing.
Sure. It's the network effect. And we see it demonstrated in Bitcoin, where Bitcoin exists because we all agree it shall exist and we're all willing to work at it. And so it becomes a people's currency simply because of the combinoric effect of all of our energies, and it's unstoppable. And even the banks and the countries are now admitting that Bitcoin is unstoppable and they can't do anything except maybe get on board. And now they're trying to, steer it their way and so on. Again, that won't work. And it has to do with all of us chatting together and being basically stubborn about wanting our stuff,
Well, in your reports, do you see anything about other cryptocurrencies? Because I know a lot of countries are trying to create their own cryptocurrency so they can completely control stuff.
We do have lots of instances of individual cryptocurrency kind of names showing up. We also have a longer term data set view of the world that there are indeed lots of cryptocurrencies, some of which will just later on just exist for brief periods of time and then fade away. Like you might think of as a cryptocurrency for a concert event or something that might be highly sought after and where it's bid up. And then once the concert's over, everybody keeps it as a souvenir, but it's no longer traded other than as souvenir grade. So new kinds of cryptocurrencies that we're going to be coming into. So the world in that regard is going to be very busy and noisy, but at its core and reigning for as far as our data can look out is Bitcoin. Now, we do see, by the way, we do see Dash, we see Ethereum, we see Monero. There's a few other names that are starting to pop up because they've got special attributes, but they don't have enough of a chatter level right now for me to be able to do any kind of like price forecasting other than to say, yeah, they look like they'll be here a year from now.
So there isn't a cryptocurrency that maybe Sweden will put in place and that's their currency.
No, we see a lot of these that they'll do that, but really all it is yet another vehicle to buy a Bitcoin.
Oh, I see. Okay. So Bitcoin ends up kind of like the dollar is right now in a lot of countries.
More like gold, because the idea of a reserve currency is going to fade away. There won't be such a thing anymore. And so gold or money will be the reserve currency. And ultimately, in that sense, I suppose Bitcoin would become that because it would be global and it would be the people's money.
Okay. So you talk about the economic crash and you bring on London. You bring up London a lot. Is that the city of London?
Yes. Yeah. The actual separate from the UK, separate from England, city of London, the actual geopolitical entity in and of itself.
Okay. So what is their involvement and what is with this?
They're the center of one arm of the pedophilia network for Faction A. Because bear in mind, Faction A is multinational. It's not simply the deep state includes parts of the UK, parts of NATO, et cetera. So London is the center of a one particular arm of this, and they're also the center of the global precious metals manipulation, although they don't do a lot of it at the moment. But as that stuff's fading, it's going to expose a lot of the problems that they've got there. And from there, all of the other threads are going to unravel, so to speak, and lead us into the corruption that we'll find here in the United States, but also within NATO. And this is where we start getting in some of the breakdowns in the precious metals manipulation. And once that occurs, then the transparency that we're expecting is going to really start rushing out, because the data shows that faction A and faction B are going to use truth and instances of it as weapons against each other. And we just saw one of those come out now with the release of the Vault 7 stuff from the CIA this morning.
What was released this morning with Vault 7?
It's a treasure trove. I've only just started looking at it. They had to get in and do interviews, so I only had maybe 10 or 15 minutes in it. But it's details about how they do things, how the CIA, all their malware, their exploits. It's like a spy kit, open source spy kit. So if you were a cracker, hacker, or just a script kiddie and you wanted to get in and play with some of these things, here's how the CIA did it. Here's how they used this malware to crack your Samsung television and turn on the microphone without you knowing it.
So it just really gives you the details of how CIA is operating and how they're doing it.
Correct. And see, here's the thing. This is a huge economic, a lot of people are going to miss this. All right. So you'll see a lot of individuals sort of dismiss this as being a sort of one-off, maybe like a WikiLeaks kind of a thing. But a lot of the economics guys should be paying attention to this. The reason is that the CIA and the NSA do 99.999% of all of their spying for economic reasons. They don't do it for political reasons whatsoever. They're not trying to track terrorists or do any of that. If they happen to undercover one, they may throw a bone to Congress or somebody and say, oh, well, look, we think these bad guys are going to do something. But what they're really doing is spying for corporations, getting the details on deals in Russia and Turkey and all of this sort of thing, so that our corporations can undercut, sabotage the deals and get the business, or so that our faction A could use that same kind of a tactic to break a country or break a corporation that was in their way. So it's all at that level. Now here you have Russia, China, everybody seeing how it was done by the CIA with all the malware and all this stuff. So all of a sudden walls are going to start going up and it's going to start breaking down. Business is going to get tougher because our corporations that are friends with the CIA won't be able to blackmail the heads of state to giving them the bids because they won't have the ability to, you know, snoop on the heads of state's email, et cetera, et cetera. And so the ramifications are huge. The fact that the citizens will be able to look at some of this and say, oh, look, I can do this and that Samsung unit won't work, or oh, I can do this and they can't track my car anymore. That's a good benefit for us, but it's all trivial compared to the economic impact of what's going to happen over the next couple of years, as the vast machine that is the spying apparatus is turned off in favor, no longer be working for corporations, for faction A.
So will that have an effect on our economy in a negative way?
Sure, globally. But let's start being real pedantic here, okay? Let's start really getting into terms. It'll have a negative effect on the financial system first. There will be some fallout into the economy, but the economy is toast as it is now, so it's not going to get much worse per se, right? You've got 23 to 29% unemployment pretty much nationwide, some places as high as 48 or 58%, depending on the demographic. So, the economy does not exist as an economic thriving unit. The only thing that's been keeping the economy going has been the dribble down effect of the money printing from the central banks. As this is waning, the financial system that is oppressing us, as it is dying, our economic activity will start blooming again. And as you said earlier, I agree, we are in a renaissance that's going around globally. And maybe a year from now, the young people in the United States will be able to get up enough and get beyond the financial system to start participating in this global economic renaissance and revolution.
Well, one thing that you said about the young people is humanity's evolving and they're able to understand more complex structures. Can you talk about that? I think that's a very positive thing.
Oh, it's a tremendously positive thing because it means that they can't be controlled by the broadcast media. The broadcast media is legacy technology where we would all sit hypnotized by the little tubes because there was basically nothing else. And it was a way of sharing a national cultural identity. It worked for a while. And then we have the internet, and now we have the ability to dial in what you want to look at. And what's been happening is that people are thereafter able to pace their own intellectual evolution. They can educate themselves. And so we are now having, for the first time in history, or at least the first time since probably the 1700s, where in the 1700s, if you were an educated individual, it may be common to run into an educated individual who is erudite, well-read, understood what he read, had good comprehension, and they may be relatively common, but it was uncommon to run into somebody who was schooled, because schooling was rare. It was more for the privileged and so on. So if you were educated, you had to be like Lincoln. You had to go to the trouble of finding a book, teaching yourself to read, and so it was a self-directed and self-described adventure, and we're now back to that with the internet.
And that's all the time we have today for this interview. We will be playing the rest of it on Wednesday on my 3 p.m. show, or you can get it on podcast version at my website, sarahwestall.com, or the 90 other places my podcast airs, or you can hear it on my YouTube channel, which you can also subscribe to. Or if you want to hear updates of anything I have going on in the future, please subscribe to my newsletter as well. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.